Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers. This is a bonus episode. This is going to serve as part five of our talks about the Spanish Armada. So this episode is intended basically as a postscript, tying up some loose ends, discussing some topics that were sort of tangential to the action of the story itself. So I'm here, as always, with Taylor. Taylor, how's it going?
It is pretty good. Excited to put a bow on the Spanish Armada series. It's been quite a journey, but it's been really interesting. I've learned a lot, so it's been fun.
Yeah, it'll be fun to wrap things up and, you know, go different directions with some of my podcasting time. We have some fun topics to cover here.
Plus, it's always fun to play the what if game in history.
Yeah, that's kind of what we'll start with here. So yeah, the first topic that's of interest here is this big kind of overarching hypothetical of what if the Armada had landed? That's the massive what if, one of the big historical what ifs, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, given the way that the Armada story has been nagged by these allegations of, you know, incompetence and mismanagement, which, as we've detailed in our last four, is by and large not true. Something that really gets overlooked in a lot of the traditional tellings is the real possibility it had of success.
I think that's something in history that is easy to overlook, is that at the time of like whatever event you're looking at, like it's not known if something's going to be successful or not. So like even like the June 6th landings in Normandy in World War II, like looking at it now, it's really easy to look at it and be like, oh, of course it was a success and it happened mm-hmm. this way because of these things. But like at the time, you have no idea of knowing if it's going to be successful or not. And same thing here, where at the time this is a real threat and there's a million different ways this could have gone other than the way that it actually happened.
And to draw back on the D-Day, the June 6th example of, it is one of those things where, like with anything, you take this big risk and it does come off, but thinking about the real possibility of this being a devastating failure. And then, mm-hmm. you know, of course, you'd probably have the historian saying, well, why did they ever think that this would work?
I mean, you can play the same game with like Operation Sea Lion on the German side of invading Britain. It's easy just to look at it and think, oh, that's a crazy plan that would have never worked. But at the time, it was probably very real.
Or with Napoleon's plans to invade England. He had his army in Boulogne basically ready to go. And, you know, things didn't really break the right way. But yeah, here we have another one of those big what ifs. We had those significant oversights at the highest levels of the Armada, coming from Philip and his sort of misguided plans for how he wanted this to look. But we've seen how on the, you know, the command level, the tactical level, things went about as well as they could have gone.
Mm-hmm.
Up until Calais, when they have to stop and wait for Parma. Parma is getting ready to go. He does have his guys loading onto ships and getting ready to invade. But by the time they're anywhere close to ready, the Armada's already been scattered.
It's interesting, too, that like at the time, everyone's a lot more even in terms of military capabilities. Like if the Spanish had been able to get a foothold in Britain, that fighting is kind of more 50-50. Whereas nowadays, it, you know, in general, one nation is much more powerful than the other. If Russia could kill Zelensky, they would mm-hmm. have done it. Whereas here, you know, once the Spanish invade, there's a real chance that they're going to start taking out nobles and capture the king.
Or the queen in this case.
Yeah, the queen, yes.
Although, as we'll talk about later, she has the heart of a king.
Of course, because for reasons.
And so, yeah, I mean, really, Philip's insistence on this rendezvous at sea in this location, it kind of exposes both bodies of troops to more risk than they reasonably should have had.
I think there's, like, to take another World War II example, because it's what I know better than this, there's like a bit of like Operation Market Garden going on here. Like it's a plan, but it's a very intricate plan. Mm. And you just don't have the logistical capabilities at the time to actually make this work. I keep going back to that like Philip's plan of this rendezvous at sea and combined arms and marine infantry, like this is a plan from the 1800s at best, but more like the 1900s. Like this, mm-hmm. this plan is just not achievable with like the logistics that they have at the time.
It goes back to the classic adage of how, you know, no plan survives contact with the enemy. Mm-hmm. And this is a great example of like, this plan works totally fine unopposed.
Yeah, that's where I get with like Operation Market Garden. Like Montgomery has a great plan. It looks great on paper, but then it comes time to support it and make it happen. And it's just not quite possible.
Yeah, I don't know much about Market Garden. I just know that it was a failure. Take that off the table. You know, if you think of either a direct invasion from the Armada itself landing in England, or basically any other way to get Parma across the channel, if the Army of Flanders lands in England, it doesn't bode well at all for the English. This is arguably the best army in the world at the time. Barring a miracle, there's not a lot the English can do in a pitched battle against the Army of Flanders.
What, what's the English situation? You may address this further, but as far as, like, what's their standing army or their, like, regular army? Do they have that, or is it mostly militia?
So on that note, England doesn't really have a standing army, at least not one that they can deploy in defense against the Armada.
Mm-hmm.
So they did have regular troops stationed in Ireland, like we talked about.
Well, that's not Britain. Why are there British troops in Ireland?
In part four. But as we said, they didn't have a lot of those. So they have some garrison troops in Ireland, and they have some stationed in Berwick on the border with Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that, anybody who knows what they're doing militarily is in the Netherlands. Got a few thousand English soldiers in the Netherlands, and that's the bulk of England's standing regular forces. So that being the case, and I'll talk more about the militia system coming up here, you're trying to face down the best army in the world with one of the most celebrated commanders in the world with militia. Things breaking the right way, Spanish troops could have been in London in as little as a week. London's defenses were super outdated and really unsuited for defending against anything like modern or contemporary siege weapons, which is something that had been planned for. We've talked about some of the logistical failures, but as we talked about with the Trinidad Valencera, she was carrying the heavy siege guns and siege carriages that would have been used in this siege of London or any other fortified place. So Philip was at least predicting Parma's need for those.
Yeah, it's interesting hitting back on, you know, kind of the English militia system and how that's working. Reading that Wars of the Roses book, it's funny how, like, there isn't really, like, a standing army. And I don't imagine that's changed that much in this time, like, in the time period from the Wars of the Roses to the War of the Roses till, you know, what we're talking about here. I doubt there's a major change. It's just funny that there's not, like, it's a lot of lords and dukes being like, hey, all of you, follow me. Like, it's time.
And that actually is an interesting change from that time to here that we'll get into. Is we still don't have a standing army, but we also don't have your regional lords with their own armies. Mm-hmm. So you don't even have them to call on if you need them.
Yeah, it's really, like, I found that interesting in that book where it's like, you know, the Duke of York rounds up his people and says, you know, march with me to London.
Historically, that's why being the Duke of York was such an important position, because you're basically the only noble who on his own has the ability to muster almost as many troops as the king or the queen does, just because of the lands that you possess. So that was always, you know, a position of power, but also one of, you could easily find yourself being distrusted or mm-hmm. falling out of favor because the king or queen is uncomfortable with how much power you have.
Or, like, maybe you're in Ireland and you come back from Ireland kind of unannounced and just show up and you're like, hey guys, how's it going?
So talking about their system, any fighting in the defense of London would have been done by the quote, trained bands.
Mm-hmm.
So this was just an evolved version of the old county militia system.
How trained are we talking?
There's a pretty wide range. This is true all the way through the English Civil Wars. Trained is a relative term, depending on where.
So this is like their version of the National Guard?
I would assume that there's more standardization of the National Guard, but yes, this is the closest thing they have. Some of those changes from the old system came in the training and the armament of the men, and also organizing the system under the direction of the Lord Lieutenant. So he had more direct power than the old mustering commissioner system. There really wasn't a centralized commissioner in the old mm-hmm. system. So again, a wide range in numbers also that could be mustered from county to county, of course. You know, some you've got as little as 200 or 300, whereas a county like Kent, you know, they can muster like 7,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's a range in just how trained these trained bands were. Neil Young estimates that only between half, maybe as high as...
You said Neil Young.
Neil Young. Him too. Neil Younger estimates that only between half and two-thirds of the trained band troops had received even nominal training.
Interesting.
And this training could have been as little as, you know, standing on a village green with a long stick that's supposed to be a pike.
This kind of reminds me of countries that have the really stringent service requirements where, like, everyone gets military training at some point. Mm-hmm. Like in Russia, where you've got, you know, you'll see these crazy numbers of, like, potential deployable troops. And in reality, like, a lot of the training that most of them have gotten is, like, maybe they got a uniform and maybe they got yelled at for a day. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not actually usable for anything more than literally what you see in somewhere like Bakhmut, where they just are numbers.
Again, a good bulk of any of the actual trained, experienced soldiers, they were already deployed in the Netherlands, not available for defense of the kingdom itself. Any open battle between a hardened Spanish tercio from Flanders and a trained band would have been probably over in minutes, if that. There's a small number of troops available from the personal assets of different nobility and clergy, but this is one of those big changes during the Tudor monarchy, is that, you know, starting with Henry VII, the nobles had been significantly hamstrung in their ability to independently organize their military forces.
Probably a good thing.
Right, because Henry VII had, you know, this is what he had seen happen, or this is what had happened in England over the previous decades, is all of these dukes and earls being able to muster their own armies. And he says, you know, when I'm king, that is not going to happen anymore.
Yeah, I was really surprised, you know, reading about War of the Roses and all that, that it, like, wasn't uncommon for some noble to, like, march his people to London and be like, I want something from you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
like, that just happened. And, like, there were riots and things like that. Like, they did January 6th just all the time. Yeah, it was just constant January 6th.
That is gone, basically. That's no longer a thing. So, yes, on the one hand, that threat is taken away, but also that asset is taken away. If you're the king, you can't suddenly call up thousands of trained soldiers from one of your nobles.
Yeah, you don't have, like, your Viet Cong just waiting to go.
So another obstacle in the defense of England was the nature of service in the trained bands.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that's probably common to militia all over the world at any given time. But men were selected and trained to defend their home county, and they were really reluctant to serve very far outside of it.
I always find that interesting because, like, all right, let's just say I'm from Ukraine, but I'm from, like, the western part of Ukraine. But, like, if I don't go fight in the eastern part of Ukraine, at some point the Russians are going to be in the western part.
True.
I've always found that interesting, that, like, the whole, like, I don't want to serve outside of my local area.
I think it makes less sense in a modern conflict where we, you know, have, you know, rapid industrialized forces. In a situation like this, it definitely does make sense. You know, if I'm a villager from Cheshire,
mm-hmm.
why do I want to march to Kent and fight against the Spanish when I could just stay home and, you know, defend my village if I need to? But, like, I probably won't, you know, once the Spanish take London, they're not going to march all the way over here.
That's true. I guess, like, your day-to-day life probably doesn't even really change that much, except for, like, maybe it's time to be Catholic now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a possible change. You go to a different church.
But I just feel like nowadays, like, you know, when the Canadians come for Mackinac, like, mm-hmm. it would be time, because it's like Toledo's next and Ohio's not giving up Toledo.
Domino theory from Canada. See, this is the same problem that you see in the English Civil War. Mm-hmm. A significant amount of those battles are fought by men in trained bands. But if you're a noble who has organized this army, you've successfully defeated the enemy. A lot of your army's not going to march with you to the next place you need to go.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to stay home because that's not what they signed up to do.
I mean, I guess you even see this in the American Civil War. I mean, this is still a thing at that point.
I mean, the War of 1812 also famously, like, a lot of the, you know, the northeastern states, they had much less of a bone to pick with Britain, and so just didn't send a lot of people to fight this. So, yeah, those trained bands, even in the Civil War, they have a pretty wide range in ability. Most of them are considered not very good, with the exception of Philip Skippon's London trained bands. They're considered pretty capable. And again, they're from London. They have probably the best access to resources. They have the best training. So
more people,
other factors in play there too.
I guess that also factors in there too, where you just have a bigger pool to select from. Whereas if you're in a smaller place, like, oh, your right arm is injured and doesn't work right, well, we still need bodies. Get in there.
We talked about this before, but a lot of these people that are being assembled, they're not being assembled with modern weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a pike might be the most advanced piece of weaponry that they could hope to get their hands on. Some of these guys are showing up with bows and arrows that are, you know, passed down through their family, probably taking it down off the mantelpiece. Yeah, it's an interesting time, and it kind of gives you an example of, yeah, they're going up against not just a professional army, but probably one of the most hardened professional armies in the world at the time.
Yeah, I kind of forget that, like, Spain hasn't begun its decline yet at this point. A lot of the history I know, Spain is kind of the original, like, sick man of Europe, almost.
This is, like, peak Spanish power. They've yet to suffer a massive defeat. But they're coming. So some recent writing has been a little bit more favorable about England's ability to defend itself in the event of a successful Spanish landing. So if not in open battle, the likelihood of a protracted resistance is pretty high.
Right.
And really, this doesn't even have to be a hypothetical. To see an example of this, you can look at a war that Spain is already involved in, the Dutch Revolt. This is a war that's already been going on for decades. It's going to continue on for decades more until 1648. And so on paper, the situations have some similarities. You have, you know, Spain facing off against a nation with less manpower, significantly weaker armed forces, and you'd have this population that's really stirred by their religious, their ideological convictions in opposition to Spain. You know, Spain's already failing to put down this kind of simmering conflict in the Netherlands, and that war had just devolved into this absolutely brutal series of sieges and counter sieges with very little open combat, which is what mm-hmm. Spain is going to excel at.
Right. And I feel like the longer you can make it protracted, the longer you can stress the Spanish supply lines. I mean, it's not modern day. You can't just fly C-130 in with supplies. Like, there's not even a guarantee that it makes it from the mainland to Britain when you set sail.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen just the logistical issues of getting people there, you know, let alone supporting an army in a foreign country.
Mm-hmm.
So all that being said, England's cities weren't as prepared to resist sieges as many of those fortress towns in the Low Countries were. The ones that had walls, you know, some of these walls are just the same medieval walls that they used the last time that they came under attack.
Mm-hmm.
So any sort of modern siege train is going to deal with these walls in, you know, probably a matter of hours. The Duke of Parma himself was on record playing up the strength of the English defense.
If I set foot on shore, it will be necessary for us to fight battle after battle. My force will thus be so reduced as to be quite inadequate to cope with the great multitude of enemies.
So it should be noted here that Parma is writing this during the planning stages of the Armada. Mm-hmm. We know Parma was opposed to this plan in the first place. He wanted to deal with the Netherlands first and then go deal with England. It's possible some of that is coloring his description. Maybe he wants to make this sound more difficult than he thinks it will be. But still, realistically, he knows what he's dealing with. He's dealing with it right now in the Netherlands. He knows that they're not just fighting whatever assembled military forces the English have. He's fighting a whole country, essentially. You know, when he talks about battle after battle, they're probably going to crush any concentrated force of English troops, but that's, you know, not even the half of what they're going to have to deal with.
I feel like somewhere in like 2002, 2003, there was some like salty old guy that had been in Vietnam for like 8 years, and he was telling us the same thing about Afghanistan. Like, hey, guys, it's not going to be that simple.
Right,
and no one listened to him. And like, this is kind of eternal. You're looking at the same kind of struggle, and, you know, it doesn't change like the kind of asymmetrical warfare that goes on when you're trying to occupy a country. Like, it kind of pisses people off. People don't want to be occupied.
Yeah. And the fact that the action itself is constantly generating more opposition. Mm-hmm. Someone who may have been neutral on paper, as soon as their father or brother is killed in combat or strung up in a church by a rampaging Spanish tercio, you've made a whole new family of enemies.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting, you know, talking about how people from a certain area don't want to fight until it affects them. The further you push, the more enemies you're creating at that point, because all of a sudden you become someone else's problem.
So despite the fact that if you like ran this scenario in like a real-time strategy game or something, it would be over very quickly. After the fact, the stresses, the reality of occupation that many modern militaries could attest to definitely comes into play here. Mm-hmm. And I think Parma knows that. So one of the most famous stories associated with the Armada is Queen Elizabeth's speech to her assembled army at Tilbury Camp during her visit on August 18th and 19th. A note here on dates. I really should have included this note in the main series somewhere, but this comes up in all the books you read about it. Most sources that are published now have their dates standardized to follow the Spanish system, because Spain had already switched to the new Gregorian calendar.
Mm-hmm.
But because that was a Catholic thing, Protestant Europe had not. The English are still using the old style. So in English sources from the time, they're giving dates that are about 10 days earlier than the Spanish dates. It does cause some confusion with dates, because if you're reading these contemporary English sources, mm-hmm. the dates seem wrong compared to what you've been reading other places.
It is weird seeing the different dates.
Most of the books you read now, there's usually a note that says, hey, we're using the Spanish dates, unless this is a direct quote from an English source, because the Spanish dates are what we would call the correct date now. So this is Elizabeth going to Tilbury Camp on August 18th and 19th. So some of the speech that Queen Elizabeth allegedly, that's in italics and scare quotes, gave to her soldiers is probably familiar to listeners.
We shall fight them on the beaches. We shall fight. It's that.
It's a kindred spirit to that speech. We will never surrender.
I literally pulled that up just so I could start quoting it. I am come amongst you, as you see, at this time, not for my recreation and disport, but being resolved, in the midst and heat of battle, to live or die amongst you all, and to lay down for my God, and for my kingdom, and for my people, my honor and my blood, even in the dust. I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too. I think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm.
So that's a famous speech that's been depicted in various forms of art in the Cate Blanchett movies, the Elizabeth. There's the DVD cover of the Golden Age. She's, you know, wearing her armor,
mm-hmm.
which is a detail that comes up in some of these depictions. There's several different versions of what Elizabeth said to these assembled troops, if anything.
Question. Mm-hmm. You may not know. I mean, it may not really be an answerable question. I just noticed that she's in this quote, in theory, you know, she's kind of separating Britain from Europe. Do the British not view themselves as European at this point? Do they view themselves as those Europeans and we're British?
Well, it's interesting here, because this is about the time, and a lot of these Elizabeth myths surrounding her, this is kind of the time when some of that starts to arise. This feeling that, first of all, England is a unified nation. And secondly, there's something special. There's something unique that separates England from the rest of Europe. I think for a lot of this, the concept of Europe is being tied in to the Catholic Church, the association of old Europe.
So Europe is almost a synonym for Catholic.
Yeah. I can't really speak that much about kind of now how, you know, the whole concept of Europe is a large island off the coast of Britain, that sort of thinking. But I don't know. It's an interesting time, certainly, because a lot of those myths are starting to develop.
Interesting.
various accounts about her appearances. So most famously, whether or not she was wearing armor. Some accounts say that she arrived in this glistening, you know, silver armor. She's carrying a sword, although in some accounts it's just a baton like a general would hold.
She just shows up in the Zelensky like sweatsuit.
Right. But it is interesting to draw those comparisons because, like, you know, when a leader, whether it's Zelensky or someone else, you know, when they make the decision to give a Zoom conference or whatever, and, you know, they're still wearing like their fatigues or something from the battlefield, it's like, yeah, they probably did have time to change, but that's the image that they're trying to cultivate.
Yeah, it is interesting in like leadership like that, how much image actually does matter.
So Susan Fry, so she has a wonderful article called The Myth of Elizabeth at Tilbury. So I quote her a few times here, and she has this to say.
What happened at Tilbury may be unascertainable, but the fictions that surround the queen can help us construct why, at the end of the 16th century, the ruling elites of court and London sought to emphasize her role in the defeat of the Armada. At the same time, examination of these fictions reveals how they perpetuate the belief in an England first united under Elizabeth, a belief that constructs Elizabeth I as a personally complex but politically monolithic figure.
So in trying to spin this, you know, as Elizabeth the unifier, Elizabeth the personal protector of the realm, a lot of weird stuff happens with some of these stories.
I'm sure.
The weirdest of them being this myth in some of the older writings about this, that Charles Howard, the Lord Admiral of the fleet, was Catholic, and he was, you know, setting aside his religious convictions, his faith, in order to, you know, demonstrate and prove his loyalty to his queen. And I think anyone with a cursory knowledge of England at the time would know that they wouldn't have put a Catholic in charge of the fleet to defend against the Spanish Armada.
Yeah, I feel like being Catholic, there's probably a pretty hard cap on like how far you're allowed to make it in a position of power.
Right, and I don't know as much about Tudor England, but Elizabeth was very much in favor of, you know, as long as you outwardly conform to what we're looking for, I really don't care what you're doing, you know, in the privacy of your own home. But still, like, there's no historical evidence to support the fact that Charles Howard was Catholic.
I think it's interesting here. I think we look at it through a 21st century lens sometimes of the state being this like we can't imagine, you know, Great Britain or France or Spain or America not existing as the state. And like at the time, these are all like more nebulous concepts of what's a state. And like your religion may be more important to you than
I am
English. Like, so it is interesting that this story is even being told of like, oh, he's such an upstanding guy that like he's putting aside his religion and, you know, he is an Englishman.
I didn't include this in the notes, but leading up to this point, there had been some government efforts to sort of defang any sort of Catholic threat. And one of those was, and this is kind of an interesting, surprisingly woke religious oppression, confiscating weapons from, you know, any known Catholics, saying you can't have these. That seems on the face of it pretty standard for religious intolerance. But what happened with these is they collected those weapons. Those weapons were sold to, you know, whoever wanted them. That's a way that they could support, you know, local militias, local lords who wanted to beef up their defenses. And the money that they made from those sales was actually given back to the original owners of the weapons.
That's like a gun buyback program.
Yeah, it's like a forced auction, basically.
Like, I swear, the more I read about history, I realize that, like, nothing is new.
Looking at the efforts of the English government to try and tread a middle ground of saying we can't just crush the Catholics under our boot, mainly because there's too many of them, and a lot of them are too influential. Even into the reigns of, like, the Stuarts, you have lords who are openly Catholic, or you have, you know, local gentry who are openly Catholic. And as long as they can pay the recusancy fines, there's really no complications. So it kind of led to Catholicism being a trendy thing for the richer people to be able to do because they were the only ones who could openly practice this. Let's see. So later in that same article, Fry writes,
"The construction of Elizabeth I as a historical subject owes a great deal to this speech, in spite of doubts about its authenticity.
So this idea that Elizabeth appeared in front of her troops, she gave this rousing speech, you know, she's armed, she's armored, she's ready for a hypothetical battle with the Spanish, it clearly supports this idea of a queen as a representative of England's increasing military power. These stories about her, you know, they only gain in detail the later and later they're published. The most famous depiction of the speech doesn't come out until the 1620s. It's referred to in a letter by people who are discussing the possible Spanish match for Charles I. At this point, he's just the prince. And there was the kind of attempts to marry Charles to a Spanish princess. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of consternation from some of the English saying, well, we just got done dealing with the Spanish. You want to marry this kid off and bring them back? So a note here, though, we mentioned the dates of this. This her visit to Tilbury Camp happened on the 18th and 19th of August. And if you're thinking back to our dates from the Battle of Gravelines, you're thinking, isn't that like over a week later? Isn't the Spanish Armada already scattered and fleeing northward? And the answer is yes. The Armada had already been defeated, but this is further example of what we talked about. The magnitude of this victory, or even the reality of it, wasn't recognized for quite some time after. They still think that this Armada is a significant threat, even though they've suffered this one defeat, because they don't really know the whole internal story.
Right.
The Armada's up around Scotland. Elizabeth is giving this rousing defense, saying that she's ready to die on the battlefield against Spain.
I, too, am ready to fight and die on the battlefield when my enemy is running away.
There's still Parma, who, like you can see in her speech, he's the one that she mentions by name. He's mm-hmm. the one that they kind of see as the bigger threat. There is some legitimacy to some of her concerns here. But that never panned out. The location here, Tilbury, in Essex, this was the designated concentration point for the English forces assembling near London. This was being done by Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester. He'd been authorized to assemble 17,000 foot and 2,000 horse for the defense of the capital. The assembly started pretty late. They started this on August 2nd. It's like while the Armada's already in the channel.
Yeah, I feel like that is a late start.
Leicester is famous as one of Elizabeth's court favorites and a possible lover of Queen Elizabeth.
I feel like there's like 30 people who are possible lovers.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Ask Sir Walter Raleigh how it turned out for him.
Well, fine for him as long as Elizabeth was.
I guess so. That wasn't around. Elizabeth, was it?
Leicester actually had some complaints that he was having to do everything around the camp. Two others who'd been appointed as organizers, these were Sir John Norris and Sir Roger Williams. They apparently rode to Dover to try and watch the Armada for themselves.
I love it. That's just guys being dudes to be like, no, hey, I want to go see it.
Let's go watch a sea battle. Leicester recorded his complaints as follows in a letter to Francis Walsingham.
If you saw how weakly I am assisted, you would be sorry to think that we here should be the front against the enemy that is so mighty if he should land here.
So Leicester is having to do basically everything administratively, you know, provisions, equipment, recruitment, organization. So I guess being the queen's favorite occasionally does come with some work.
It does. That probably does suck after like not doing anything for years and just being one of the queen's favorites.
Well, this is also interesting because like we see Francis Walsingham there yet again. We talked about him with a lot of these accounts of the Armada when they write these letters about what happened. They're writing it to Walsingham. Walsingham is her secretary, but he's also her intelligence master. And so a lot of this communication is going through him. We'll actually see later another example of this.
So he's like the guy that actually knows everything?
Basically, if something is getting done, it's probably Walsingham who's doing it. So looking at some contemporary propaganda. Propaganda is fascinating, and there's quite a bit of it surrounding the Spanish Armada. One of those is from Robert Greene. And it's called The Spanish Masquerado. Robert Greene is an English dramatist, and he published this pamphlet in 1589, which Anthony Esler describes as
part of the flood of journalistic jubilation aroused by the amazing English victory over the Spanish Armada in the running sea fight of July and August 1588.
So this work actually was so popular that it got reissued for a second round of printing. But the time is interesting in that it doesn't come out until early the following year. Esler describes this work as, quote, a book intended not so much to stir up popular enthusiasm, but to cash in on it. Another modern sentiment. We can
it
see
really
here.
Is.
The pamphlet takes advantage of stereotypes and slanders that would have been very familiar to English readers in its portrayal of Spain and the Catholic Church.
The monks, friars, and priests, caricatured in Chapter 5, and the Roman cardinals, dealt with in Chapter 3, are depicted sitting banqueting with the fair nuns, stall-fed with ease and gluttony, and crammed to bursting with sins of the flesh.
So they've depicted the Catholic Church kind of cartoonishly as all of these things that would have been familiar complaints to Protestants of the time.
I mean, under certain popes, they weren't wrong.
Sure. Caricaturized figure of this fat, indolent, sexually promiscuous friar or priest. All these things are not supposed to be doing, and damn it, they're doing it. But I think what's most interesting, the way that Philip is depicted in the work gives some insight into how he may have been seen by a contemporary English audience. We've seen Philip as the ultimate driving force behind the Armada. In the moment, readers at the time, they probably would have had a very different view of him, seeing him really as just a tool employed by a far, far greater evil, the Pope.
Here is the most powerful monarch in Europe, debasing himself before the Church of Rome. He's depicted wearing the costume of a hermit, the poorest of Roman religious fanatics. He is revealed in wretched case, followed only by a handful of savage menials, riding not on a powerful war horse, but a lowly mule, like the poorest friar. And he is shown riding towards the church, a piece of symbolism that would have been plain as a pikestaff to Green's readers, even without the motto, "The church commands, I dare not dissent."
So despite all that earthly power that we've talked about with Philip, in episode one, we talked about all these places that he was in charge of, all of the gold and silver from the New World, all of this stuff, none of that compares to the power of this great evil one, the true Antichrist in Rome. Philip is essentially just his slave. The Pope is quite literally depicted as the beast of the apocalypse by Green. He draws out this allegory for all this religious upheaval in Europe throughout the 16th century, what we would, you know, in retrospect, look back and call it the Reformation.
The beast of apocalypse ravages all Europe until at last he is tracked down by a pack of faithful bloodhounds. Luther, Huss, Zwingli, and grievously wounded by a troop of royal huntsmen led by the redoubtable Henry VIII. Licking his wounds, the beast next turns upon Queen Elizabeth, but with divine aid, she easily withstands his assaults, and her eventual victory seems assured.
So the last bit kind of highlights what we talked about with who gets the credit for these things. We said how Philip, you know, despite the failure of the endeavor, Philip was very conscious of supporting and treating the people right who had sacrificed life and limb for his project. Elizabeth, on the other hand, was not. She was not forthcoming with any sort of support or, you know, social or monetary for anyone who had participated in this. Instead, a lot of the English narrative is all about God. God gave us this victory. No one should be taking any credit for this except for God. You know, to one of her sailors who's lost a leg and is, you know, living on the streets, that probably doesn't help very much.
In victory, it's very much like, well, thanks for your sacrifice. Everything's back to normal now.
Let's see.
I'm kind of also, I think of like the band played Waltzing Matilda, where at the end, the guy lost limbs in World War I, and they kind of talk about, well, why is everyone marching in this remembrance parade? Like, what are we even remembering? Because my life didn't get any better after it was over.
You'd probably have a lot of stories like that coming out of the English fleet. So Esler finishes by pointing out the dual conflicting natures of this type of propaganda piece. So on the one hand, you can see this as England suddenly free from this looming threat of this foe that was up to this point seen as largely invincible.
Greene's Elizabethan readers could exult at the spectacle of the invincible Spanish caballeros tasting at last the bitter pill of defeat. In Greene's pamphlet, Valdes, Medina, Sidonia, and their fellows thus became symbols of the dawning English conviction that the Spaniards could, after all, be beaten.
So that part, you know, again, not so much saying that Spain is broken. They know that that's probably not true, but Spain can be beaten. On the other hand, it also reveals this lingering fear of Spain.
It is surely this very justifiable fear that brings the note of hysteria into Greene's jeering and verbal assaults on the defeated foe. His hyperbolic ridicule and extravagant efforts to humiliate the enemy represents an unconscious effort to exercise this fear of the awful power of Spain.
So we've seen some of the English side of things. A person that we mentioned at least once, I want to say, is Cardinal William Allen. So I want to discuss him for a second. Based on his title and his name, you can probably guess that he's both a prominent Catholic and an Englishman. Not a great position in 1588.
Yeah, probably not.
Allen was active in the underground, so the infiltration of Catholic priests back into England, in the hope of keeping Catholicism alive until England could be reconquered. And this is, again, one of those interesting times in England's history. Elizabeth had seen what happened, not just under Mary, you know, in her persecution of Protestants, but her other sibling, Edward, you know, the first successor to Henry VIII, you know, he had been pretty repressive to Catholics as well. And so Elizabeth wasn't super interested in punishing the average everyday English person for their religious belief. Again, outward conformity was pretty much all you needed. As long as you weren't making a fuss, it wasn't a huge deal. She wasn't going to kick down people's doors and burn them at the stake if she found, you know, a crucifix or a picture of the Virgin Mary in their house. But that same mercy did not extend to priests. That was kind of the hard line of, you know, if you are caught in England and you are a priest, you know, and you are actively disseminating this information, like, you're going to be executed. So Allen, you know, he's running this kind of network of, you know, very obviously very high risk people, you know, getting them back into England. Then Allen is organizing this from the continent, trying to keep that little fire of Catholicism alive in England until it can be relit by some sort of major military endeavor. Allen was involved in the planning of the Armada as a member of the sort of potential provisional church government that would be installed on the removal of Elizabeth. There were plans to make him Archbishop of Canterbury. For an English Catholic, hey, that's pretty much the best job you could hope for. In the summer of 1588, Allen published Admonition to the Nobility and People of England and Ireland to be distributed among the English populace. So this was a summary and an explanation of the papal bull that had excommunicated Queen Elizabeth. This was actually published by another English exile, a guy named Richard Verstegen. He operated out of Flanders, publishing pro-Habsburg literature.
Interesting.
So this interested me because this is kind of the whole like shadow war going on behind the scenes of the war of public opinion and getting people to read about these things from different perspectives. As we see now on Twitter, you know, what happens is far less important than how it's talked about and how it's right. written about from a mouthpiece that people trust to the average person. So in response to Allen's pamphlet, Lord Burghley published the copy of a letter sent out of England to Don Bernardine Mendoza. So this is some true mind games here. This was published as allegedly a letter sent by a Catholic priest operating clandestinely in England. Kind of double, triple reverse here.
Uh-huh.
And Mendoza is interesting. Another figure we talked about very briefly. He's one that would have been a well-known and very useful villain to English readers. He was that ambassador from Spain who had requested that Francis Drake be punished and probably executed for piracy, when instead he was given a knighthood. Mendoza had actually been expelled as Spanish ambassador after his role in the 1584 Throckmorton plot. Yet another plot to overthrow Elizabeth and place Mary, Queen of Scots, on the throne. Like the other plots, also uncovered by Francis Walsingham.
I feel like getting expelled at that point is like best case scenario.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's that level of immunity where you can't just string up an ambassador.
I feel like there is, but like at this point, it's also like the 1500s and like sometimes there's just not rules.
Mendoza had been in direct communication with Philip II using a secret code known apparently only to the two of them.
Interesting.
So he would have been a very easy target for vilification to an English reading populace. Burghley also received a copy of Allen's The Declaration of the Sentence and Deposition of Elizabeth. So this was intended to sort of prime the pumps for English, anticipation of a Spanish invasion. English intelligence alleged that 12,000 copies of this were to be printed in Antwerp for distribution. So with an eye towards discouraging that kind of thing, Burghley and Walsingham collaborated on a declaration against the bringing in, dispersing, uttering, and keeping of bulls from the See of Rome and other traitorous and seditious libels.
Notably prohibiting the possession of seditious reading materials, as well as the active distribution of them. The proclamation required anyone in possession of any such bull or any transcript copy thereof, or any of the said libels, books, pamphlets, or writings, which either hath come or shall hereafter at any time come, to immediately, without showing the same to any person, send the offending materials to a member of the government.
The way that that's talked about, kind of the level of toxicity placed on these things, the only thing it really reminds me of is counterfeit money.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, if you were to find yourself in possession of, like, there's, you know, very kind of strict rules about...
The only thing you can do is be like, this is not mine, someone come get this.
Exactly. Even just being in possession of it for longer than you immediately have to is problematic in itself.
I'm just trying to picture, like, what's, like, the weirdest government official you could give this to? Like, some guy who is, this just isn't his job, but he's, like, technically a government worker.
Yeah, here,
like,
take this.
The town dog catcher or something. Like, I don't want these here. You take it.
That sounds like a good premise for, like, a Tudor or, like, Stuart-era comedy.
I'm also picturing, like, the government official who's just, he's, like, got, like, a no-show job and, like, has no idea what's going on. He's just wondering why he keeps getting sent all this, like, anti-queen literature in the mail.
It reminds me a little bit of the character Dog Barry in Much Ado About Nothing, who's like the town watch guy, and he's totally inept, but he's the one who like accidentally uncovers this plot.
Mm-hmm.
So Megan J. Brown, she has an interesting perspective on the dangers associated with acknowledging the role of foreign seditious literature in England.
Reporting reactions to contested works acknowledged that those works were being read while criticizing their production. As however hasty, slipshod, or deceitful, still ran the risk of advertising the text.
Nevertheless, criticism of production methods became a staple of the justifications employed for publishing rebuttals, which often assumed their audience had, indeed, read the works they were refuting.
While the government saw print as a means of communicating justifications, theories of events, and rhetorical positions to their subjects, to see that communication as a dialogue and respond in the same venue, resulting in the gradual opening of the debates over public policy in ways the government did not perhaps anticipate or intend.
I included that because it reminds me of it makes me think of a modern sort of debate and sort of just point of contention that you see in a place like Twitter, where when someone, you know, some right-wing person, they post some just insanely, just flamboyantly transphobic, just horrendous line of argument. And you know, there's a pretty sharp divide in the people who say block, report, mute, ignore it. And then you have a large contingent who prefer to quote tweet that and mm-hmm. then dunk on it on Twitter. And you've got a divide in terms of, well, what are you trying to do? Because if you're trying to keep this out of public consciousness, why are you sharing it?
Right, because like the mere existence of it in people's faces is what the person that posted originally wants anyway.
So with those kind of violent, rampant, transphobic, homophobic, racist, whatever it is, I think there's a lot to be said about maybe don't share it. You know, if you're going to respond to it, you know, do it in a way that maybe makes it less visible. But it, like they talk about this, sort of legitimizing this by even entering into this debate, you know, by trying to refute this point by point, it's like that's not what's going to change this person's mind. There's probably nothing that's going to change this person's mind.
It's so, sort of that whole debate me bro culture that like the Charlie Kirks of the world love so much, that like by even engaging in that debate, you're legitimizing their point to a degree, and like they don't have a point that needs to be legitimized.
Entering that debate makes it, it sort of implies that there is some level of logic that would convince you. And that like can't be allowed to happen. So yeah, I think that it's interesting here the risk that they're running by publishing this rebuttal, this refutation. They're assuming that these people either have read this or they're going to now go and try to read this.
Yeah, that reminds me of like Joe Kasabian talking about like dealing with Holocaust deniers. That like there's literally no point in discussing it. Because just by discussing it, you're saying, oh, you have legitimate points that need refuted. Right. Like, there is no debate.
Another, I guess, less serious topic, but I remember this is probably 10 years ago at this point when Bill Nye debated famed creationist Ken Ham. This televised debate, and that was pretty divisive. You had people saying, well, no, this will be good because people can hear a good cogent argument laid out for evolution. Other side, you had people saying, there's no need for that. Anyone that needs to be convinced of this right now is not party to anything good that we want to be associated with.
Mm-hmm.
By giving this platform, by legitimizing it, this is only hurting us. No one who cares about this is listening to your point-by-point evidence for this theory.
Yeah, it's sort of like the Jerry Springerification of debate in a way, of just like debate for the spectacle, which isn't new. I'm sure it existed at this time too. I mean, that's not like a new feature of humanity.
A couple weeks ago, there was the story about the guy, you know, standing, doing an armed vigil at the bus stop with his like AR-15 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that one news channel. It's like, so-and-so, it's like man reported seeing, reported at bus stop with automatic weapon. We have both sides for you at 5. There's no two sides to this. Like, we don't need this to happen. There's what is the debate going on here? It's like the when people frame it as the trans debate. It's like there's no debate about people's existence.
Yeah, like they're here.
Even using that term undermines any sort of dunk or whatever you're trying to do. So like engaging with it is ultimately harmful.
And it's interesting bringing it back to Spanish Armada. Like, this stuff is kind of eternal. These debates and these type of situations have always been around.
So I guess to wrap up here, the last thing I included here, there's tons more stuff we could have talked about, but I'll share the full source list probably on Patreon, just to say all the stuff that we referred to, and you can check those out as you like, because there's a lot more cool stuff to get into. But it has to end somewhere. So I do want to end with a discussion about those papal bulls. We talked about Pope Sixtus V renewing that excommunication of Elizabeth.
I didn't realize that they expired.
The original bull against Elizabeth, Regnans in Excelsis, was issued in 1570. So this excommunicated Elizabeth and absolved her subjects of any obedience to her. This is pretty common when kings and queens got excommunicated. There was also the clause of saying, this also delegitimizes them as the monarch, so if you are their subject, you don't have to listen to them anymore.
Can you imagine the Vatican being like this political today?
Saying, hey, this guy is not the legitimate president.
Uh-huh.
Count all the votes.
If you're in line, stay in line.
It's like the Vatican has issued a papal bull regarding the Dominion voting system. So quoting here from Megan J. Brown.
Because the original bull of 1570 had been issued without political support for enforcement, it opened devout Catholics to charges of treason without offering any compensating hope of liberation.
However, this reissued bull in 1580, this came with an added clause that allowed English Catholics to obey the current government until it was politically practical to obey the church. Which, I mean, I think it's a useful thing for people who, like you said before, like, are legitimately going to be conflicted about this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they do care a lot about their religion, but at the same time, what are they going to do?
Right, except, like, be executed if they talk too much.
The Armada served as just the sort of military support that English Catholics would have needed to make that bull a reality. Mm-hmm. And that whole process, what it reminds me of is, you know, this original one saying, well, that's not the legitimate ruler, you don't have to listen to them. But with no further support, reminds me a bit of what you see mainly people on Twitter saying. You see this from, you know, your blue check liberals and stuff, but asking the people of Iran or whatever to rise up against their government. And, you know, you have to fight this. This is the way that, you know, you gain your freedom. And it's like, that sounds great, but there's no, like, what's the support for this? Like, where?
The only support that you get from those people is, like, they'll show a picture of Tehran in, like, the 1950s and be like, look, women used to wear shorts.
And so it's the same kind of sentiment of asking from a distance, saying, hey, this is what you should do. Not sort of getting the reality on the ground. So at least that reissued bull, I think, is a bit more pragmatic, knowing that, okay, like, we need to cover some bases here, because this is going to have people conflicted.
Because at some point, some, like, if you're doing too much, like, some secret police or militia is going to come knocking on your door at, you know, midnight. And, like, you don't want that. That doesn't end well for anyone.
So that was my last thing I had here in the notes. I think we covered a lot of fun stuff here that didn't quite fit during the main narrative, but it was a fun bonus episode, a dense bonus episode. But
I, you know, it was great. A shipwreck free bonus episode, basically. But I think it's great just kind of going through some of the exercises of reading this stuff and just seeing how much of it is still pertinent to today and how, mm-hmm. like, no problem that we have now is like a new problem. It's just different than it was at this time. I also think it's interesting how sharp the divide between Protestant and Catholic is here. Whereas I feel like at least in the United States nowadays, obviously there's extremists in the Catholic religion and there's extremists in the Protestant religion. But for the most part, I feel like most Catholics and Protestants just consider themselves Christians,
mm-hmm.
as not necessarily the same religion, but just a different flavor of the same thing. Whereas at this time, like, the Catholics might as well have been Muslim to the Protestants. Like, it is a different religion.
Well, right. And you even have those interactions around this time of, I mean, the very famously, France is pretty good buddies with the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And parts of Europe are like, well, how could you do this? And they're like, well, at least they're not Protestants. At least they're not.
Yeah.
At least they're not perverting our religion.
Yeah, I was in the book about the Ottomans I was reading. That was very interesting that there was a lot of that of they may be Muslim, but they're not Protestant. They're not making a mockery of our God.
Well, some of the extent of also like that's theirs. That's to an extent, that's what they're supposed to be. Like, mm-hmm. that's how they were created. Whereas the Protestants, you know, seen as, you know, they're twisting, they're poisoning.
They know better.
Yeah, they should know better. The one last final detail I'll throw in is we talked about modern concepts we see here. Another of those is the issue of fake news. We associate that very much with the modern rapid news cycle of, you know, everything updates every minute. And as soon as something gets published, it goes viral. And some of the initial Spanish reporting, you know, from Mendoza and other people, they report this as a smashing victory, saying, you know, we sank 60 English ships. Francis Drake and Lord Howard are in chains. They're being taken back to Spain. So those reports are circulating at first also, with obviously no basis in fact. So also not a modern concept.
Yep. That's one of my favorite things about, you know, doing this kind of thing and reading this kind of thing is it really helps us understand context and history better and how similar, you know, so many of these things are to what we go through now. Obviously, it's not a one for one ever. But, you know, there are people thinking about these things at this time, the same issues and problems we deal with now. So I find that very interesting.
Yep. So that's going to wrap it. That's the last we'll talk about the Armada for quite some time, probably. We may have reason to revisit it, but I think that'll do it for now.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for listening. If you're hearing this, that means you're probably a patron or you found out a way to get it for free, in which case, good for you. Yeah. So thanks for your support. We definitely appreciate it. And we look forward to putting out more of this in the future. Thank you.